The 100 Years' War. The De Guesclin Period. New Target, La Rochelle, Part 2. With the towns in no position to resist a siege, Captain Bush had no realistic alternative but to stake everything on a surprise attack on the enemy in the field. And the gamble had almost succeeded. But in the event, defeat deprived the English at a single stroke of almost all of their leaders and probably about half of their reliable troops in the southwest. In Bordeaux, the government was in the hands of the seneschal Sir Thomas Felton. He was now little more than a caretaker. There was a handful of garrisons left north of the Gironde River, but that they had been stripped to skeleton strength to reinforce Captain Bush's army. Loyalty was the only currency left to pay them with. The money salvaged from the treasury at Poitiers, which would have paid 1,000 men for a quarter, was lost when the receiver of Poitou was murdered by robbers as he tried to reach La Rochelle. In the west, the islands and the coast areas of the Saintonge surrendered to Morlet de Montmore and Jean de Rey immediately after the battle. The combined French and Castilian fleet then sailed north to blockade La Rochelle. On August 30, 1372, the main body of the French army, with the Dukes of Berry, Burgundy, Bourbon, and the Constable at its head, marched west from Poitiers to confront the surviving pockets of English and Gascon troops. On the same day, the Duke of Anjou mustered the army of Languedoc at Angers and prepared to march down the Garonne Valley. "Alas, Guienne, now you are truly lost," Captain Bush is supposedly have said to Morlet de Montmore after his capture. "What are you saying?" replied Morlet. "Guienne is won." In England, Edward III's efforts were lost in a chaos of conflicting objectives and administrative disorder. The stream of terrible news from Aquitaine reached Westminster, almost at least 2 weeks out of date and often inaccurate. The king's ministers realized by now that the whole invasion scare of June and July had been a delusion, and that the whole of Aquitaine might be lost unless drastic measures were taken to reinforce it. It was probably in the second week of August that they devised yet another strategic plan, the fourth since the beginning of 1372. A very large army, about 6,000 men-at-arms and archers, perhaps 8,000 combatants altogether, was waiting on the coast of Kent by the Downs. The new plan appears to have been to land them on the north coast of Brittany, and after relieving Belcherel, to march overland into Poitou, presumably crossing the Loire by the Bridge of Nantes. On August 11, 1372, the king left Windsor for the coast. He informed the two archbishops that he had resolved to take the war to the enemy. Unfortunately, Edward's frequent changes of plans had left him badly placed to do this. Many of the men waiting by the Downs had no horses because they had expected to be fighting at sea. There was a large fleet waiting to embark them, 376 ships, according to reports reaching the generally well-informed Italian community at Avignon. But they were in the wrong place for a descent on Brittany. Edward arrived at Sandwich on August the 27th and boarded his flagship, the Grace Dieu, but his ships were pinned to their anchorage in the Downs by stiff contrary winds, which continued to blow for a month. John Neville, on the other hand, who was waiting at Southampton with his men, was in the right place to reach Brittany, but he didn't have any ships. None of the West Country barges assigned to him had arrived. Some of them had been stolen. The chartered ships of Holland and Zealand were just enough to carry Neville's horses. They were sent ahead. Neville and his companions were compelled to kick their heels in the field about Southampton, as he explained years later when he was charged with misconduct by a vengeful parliament. On September 5, 1372, the French army arrived before La Rochelle. The citizens had already made up their minds to surrender. They had taken over the town, they had overpowered the English garrison, were being held in cells in the town jail. Froissart tells a pretty story that the captain of La Rochelle, the Englishman, Philip Mansell, not a very intelligent man, was invited to dinner by the mayor and tricked into organizing a review of the garrison. The review occurred in the plain outside the castle gates on the following morning, while the townsmen broke into the castle from behind him. The truth was probably more prosaic, a matter of sleepy sentries and scuffles at night. What is certain is that the French arrived, the citizens were furiously engaged in demolishing the citadel, so they would never again be overawed by garrisons of troops above either side. Only on September the 8th, when they had completed this task, did they open the gates to admit the French army. The English captain was delivered up to the Duke de Berry, and the Duke's troops processed in triumph through the city. The rest of Poitou's resistance swiftly collapsed. As at Poitiers, the French set about capturing all the small satellite garrison around La Rochelle, which might otherwise have made life intolerable for the newly surrendered town. The isolated castle of Benon, east of La Rochelle, was taken by storm and the entire garrison put to sword. Mérignans, north of the town, was held by a garrison of Brabant mercenaries who surrendered it and threw in their lot with the French rather than suffer the same fate. The lesson was not lost on the nobility of Poitou, who were still holding out at Thours. The Duke of Berry had written to their leaders suggesting they should come to an accommodation. The Poitvins kept their distance but were careful not to lose contact. In the middle of September, the majority of them decided to sue for terms. A few dissidents withdrew from the fortress and joined the English garrison at Noirt. The rest, the bishops of Lucon and Mazelet and 23 of the leading lay barons of Poitou, appointed plenipotentiaries to negotiate for them. They came before the Dukes of Berry and Burgundy in their camp outside Segrez, a small walled town east of La Rochelle, where the French army was engaged in the siege of the Anglo-Gascon garrison. On September the 18th, 1372, a truce was agreed for the whole province of Poitou until November the 30th. Unless Edward III or the prince in person relieved Thouars by that date, the signatories agreed to submit to French King Charles V. Charles's lieutenants undertook that they would recover all their possessions and hold them in peace as vassals of the king. At the same time, their leader, Louis d'Harcourt, having secured his rights to be restored to his domains in Poitou, entered into a private convention of his own by which the French king's lieutenants promised him the return of all of his confiscated domains in Turin and the revenues of his family barony of Saint-Sever in the Cantine as soon as it could be recaptured from the English. On the following day, September the 19th, 1372, Segur surrendered and the French invaded Saintonge and Angoumois. Conquest of these provinces was even swifter than that of Poitou. St. Jean d'Aiguille, which was defended by the remains of Captain Bush's garrison, surrendered as soon as the French army came before the walls. At Saint, the acting seneschal, William Farringdon, determined to resist. His men put up a fierce fight from the fortified bridge over the Charente, but the citizens seized the captain at night and forced him to surrender. The conquest of Angoumois was left to subordinate commanders with quite small companies of men. But it was enough. Angoulême, the prince's old capital, which more than any southern town had witnessed the magnificence of the prince's court in his prime, surrendered at about the same time as La Rochelle. Pons was reoccupied by its lord, Renaud de Pons, after more than a year in which it had been held against him by his estranged wife. The only notable town which still held out for the prince was Cognac. Its citizens would gladly have surrendered like those of so many other southern towns, and at one point agreed to do so. But the English recovered control in time to stop them, and the garrison maintained an isolated defiance until 1375. Further south, in the valley of the Garonne River, another body of French troops under the Duc d'Anjou edged closer to Bordeaux, capturing the great border fortress at La Meuse d'Angers and the western edge of the Angenesse. The whole of the remaining holdings of the English in the Angenesse had been overrun by the end of September of 1372, with the solitary exception of the fortress of Penn on the left bank of the Lot River, where an isolated Anglo-Gascon garrison continued to hold out. Penn ultimately surrendered by agreement on New Year's Day. So as we can see, the English are melting before the French, and there's not much left of their control. So we'll see how the English take this next time. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.